The following is offered by Discerning Hearts, a 501c3 nonprofit Catholic apostolate dedicated to spiritual formation through the use of new media. To download this selection, or to browse hundreds of other programs, or to contribute to our mission with a charitable donation which is fully tax deductible, visit our website at Discerning Hearts.
Welcome to the Formed Book Club, brought to you by Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute. On the program today, Ignatius Press founder and editor, Jesuit Father Joseph Fessio, Ignatius Press editor Vivian Dudrow, and best-selling author and editor Joseph Pierce. Join the program as they discuss Cardinal Robert Seurat's book, The Day Is Now Far Spent. This is part six of the discussion.
Welcome back to this session of the Formed Book Club. You'll see Joseph Pierce there on the right of your screen from South Carolina. Vivian Dudrow here, myself, Father Joseph Fessio. We are continuing discussion of this very rich book, The Day Is Now Far Spent, by Robert Cardinal Seurat. Rhymes with Arab because he's a French speaker. And in French, you always accent the last syllable, like Es Noir. That's Eisenhower. I could never understand when they said that to me in French. What? Who's that? And we have finished basically part one, Spiritual and Religious Collapse. And we began, I believe, part two, Man Belittled, which has two chapters in it, Hatred of Man, Hatred of Life. And as we've seen so many times now in this little series, he speaks with such depth and such clarity, but he's not obfuscating, he's clarifying. And even though he describes the situation in all its brutal horror, he always tells us what the basis of hope is. So we continue in the chapter Hatred of Man. I actually missed something last week. I meant to read from page 157. So Joseph likes to trump me, but can you trump me on that, Joseph?
No, you've trumped me on that one.
All right. So this is on page 157. It kind of led up to what I quoted about the natural law on 158, about a third up from the bottom there. If the only standard of our action is a positive law imposed by the will of a majority, or I would say in the United States by a minority of Supreme Court justices, we will ceaselessly be obliged to bow before something extrinsic to us that is imposed from outside. Thus, all submission to law, to an order, seems like a form of slavery to which one is compelled to consent in the name of the need to live together. And so that's exactly what happens, a positive law. And a positive law does not express and explicate and is not based on the natural law imprinted in us by God, eternal law, which is the law in his mind, then we're slaves to the majority or to a ruling minority or to an elite or to, in our system right now in the United States, often the justice system. But that led to page 158, where he said the capital importance here is to rediscover the notion of human nature as the condition for the flourishing of our freedom. So that's what I want to say about that. I'll cross it off my list. Joseph?
Well, I mean, I'll make one comment on that, if you don't mind. It's sort of on topic, but going off tangentially. The question about democracy ultimately do people have real power? And I think that the bigger that democracy gets, in other words, the bigger the government, the more it becomes a mechanized thing divorced from the needs of ordinary people. We have to actually re-enfranchise localities and re-empower local government so that people can really get a government that's responsive to what they want, rather than a government that's further and further away from them. And so we have a bogus democracy now, one which is democratic in name, but not in practice.
Well, in fact, our country did not start out as a pure democracy. It started out as a polity with three branches: executive, which was more like a monarchy, a sovereign, and a chief executive, an assembly, the Congress, and then the justice system. But So it was really a representative government, not a pure democratic government. And really, the more democratic it becomes, but on this large scale that you're talking about, the more it just gets manipulated, really, by a powerful elite. And it has just the appearance of being a democracy. A father mentioned the court system. Really, the court system keeps trumping local democratic rule. So like in California, we passed a resolution declaring marriage as being between one man and one woman, which already, if you put that to a plebiscite vote, you have to realize you have a problem. However, it got struck down by the courts.
But even in California, it passed.
It did. That's what I'm saying.
And then the court struck it down.
Exactly. So you've got, you know, what you're saying, Joseph, is absolutely true, that you have to restore not only the proper scale, but also the proper relationship, that what we really want is representative government and not pure democratic government. And but we're so far from that, who knows where it's going to end up.
Two things about that. The Catholic Church has always seen as part of the natural law what has come to be called the principle of subsidiarity.
Right.
Which is that a decision should be made at the lowest level possible, those who are closer to the circumstances and so on. And we've really lost that in the United States to a great extent. So the federal government has become much more intrusive in things that should be taken.
Right.
Or it's like local school boards ought to be the ones deciding what goes on in the schools. But that's not the case now, California right. especially. So one thing, subsidiarity. But secondly, even if you have subsidiarity and representative government, it's not just because you're smaller, you get to make up your own laws in a positive way. You have to base that on the intrinsic nature of man as the basis for your law. But it seems to me that on the lower level of this township or the county or the city, whatever, there's a lot more chance to have common sense. You don't have people becoming county supervisors because they want to somehow become full of emoluments and get rich. I mean, it's often a volunteer type job or a school board. You don't get rich being on a school board. So there's a better chance those people will not be influenced by the elites and by the wealthy.
And also they'd be answerable to people because people actually know who they are people. Right? No, it's not so far removed that they're just names they see on a TV screen. So, you know, the other thing about it is subsidiarity is completely correct. And you're completely correct, Father, that the Catholic Church actually has the answers to these problems already, if we were to listen to her. But it also that government needs to be on a human scale. It's to serve human persons, and therefore it needs to be on a human scale. And we now live in a macro government world. Even the democracies are macro democracies, and they become inhuman and therefore inhumane.
Right. Well, even Aristotle said, I mean, a lot of what the church says about government, she got from Aristotle, that the only way government works at all is with trust. And the only way you can have trust is if it's small enough for people to actually know each other, the people they govern and the people who are governed know those who govern them. And without that, it just does not work.
Now, Aristotle also actually spoke a great deal about that there's a proper, appropriate size for things.
Right.
And if something gets too big, it actually loses its very nature. And I think that's
right.
What's happening now. We're living in an undemocratic democracy because it's so far away from the people.
And he also warned that an undemocratic democracy run by technocrats would be the worst form of totalitarianism mankind would ever know. Well, there you go. There you go, Aristotle.
So what do we do now? We're discussing this book by Carlos Aran. He's brought this very important point. But what most of us here, we and our listeners, are living in the United States. Joseph is a citizen of a foreign country. He's an alien.
I'm actually a U.S. citizen, Father.
Are you now?
Hate to disappoint. See what I mean? We're about ducking and diving and his left hook missed, right?
Was that some kind of amnesty program we had?
he was a refugee.
Yeah. So, any practical things we can do here in the United States to help, you know, move in the direction of a more representative democracy, which is based on the natural law? And subsidiarity. I don't know.
Well, I think we don't want to go for too much of a tangent. It's going to take us away from the book. But one thing I would say is that you have to restore local economies. Once you have a local economy, then you would have a demand for strong local government. I think it has to be that way round. So we need to start actually patronizing small Catholic business, well, small businesses in our locale, and not use the chains where at all possible, and have revitalized our local economies, and then we'd have a local community. And once you have a local community, you have a demand for local government.
David, you want to respond to that?
Well, easier said than done, because these things can be idealized. Even the Native Americans who were here before the Europeans got here were involved in all kinds of trade and commerce and beads and shells.
I'm about trading. So, for instance, yeah. It's very practical, Vivian. We don't use Starbucks. We go to the Exchange Company, which is a locally produced local coffee place that gives 10% of all its profits. It's run by Christians to local orphans to actually help those people. We choose to buy our coffee in the Exchange Company instead of Starbucks. That's purely practical. It's not in your pie in the sky stuff. As with sanctity, you have to begin with yourself, and you have to actually start practicing what you preach and encourage other people to do it.
But I'm only trying to say that people move around, goods move around. The economy, because it's a human institution, is always going to be something flawed. And I'm not saying don't make your best efforts to buy local. I mean, here's a funny thing, right? For a while, these farmers markets from local growers. And by the way, I belong to a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture. That means every week I get a box of vegetables grown by a farmer just a few miles from here. Right? I'm supporting
a purely practical subsidiarity. Bravo.
It is practical. And quite frankly, it tastes delicious because it's picked fresh. And right. And by the way, he pays his workers, even though he doesn't have to, he pays them a fair wage. The guy, and he's probably some kind of commie leftist or something, but he has very high ideals about what he's doing, and he's local and all the rest. Okay, that's great. And I get a bonus point for doing that. But a funny thing that happened, all these farmers markets were being promoted. And now in the city of San Francisco, on any given day of the week, you can go to a farmers market somewhere in the city. And these are all local farmers. Well, guess what? There are now so many farmers markets and so many locals participating in them that the prices are being driven down, putting a lot of these small farmers out of business. Now, I'm just saying that the marketplace is farming is a tough way to make a living. Being in the marketplace is tough. There's always competition. It's not ever going to be a perfect world.
But are you saying
we're talking about perfect world? We're talking about we have a duty as Christians to make it a better world.
Yes,
we begin
to the degree
with ourselves
we can
by living holier lives, and holier lives has to include every single dollar we spend is a moral act. So, no, if we want to live as Christians, we have to be aware of how we're spending our money, because it's an ethical choice being made every time we open our wallets.
Right. And I think that there has to be also the principle that the lowest price is not necessarily the determinant. Some people have to if they have so little money. But the point is, you pay a little more sometimes to buy locally.
Right.
Because, that's right, you do.
We choose to tax ourselves to improve the world in which we live, to make the world in which we live a better place. And so we tax ourselves. That's the choice we make.
Yeah, well, but on the other hand, I mean, not on the other hand, but in addition to this, like right now we're talking, through the internet, which I don't know who owns that, if anybody owns it, but I got a computer here, which I couldn't make or buy locally.
No.
So if there weren't somebody that was doing, and how they might make this inexpensive. Well, they had it built in Taiwan or something like that.
Well, yeah, but no one.
I can't control that. So right. there are some things that we, unless we renounce society entirely, we have to be part of the.
Yeah, but no one, Father, is suggesting. Well, some people might be. There might be Luddites.
I'm not criticizing you.
I'm using my computer here. I have my computer. But I'm also a techno minimalist. In other words, I don't buy any gadgets we don't need. So that we have enough money to spend more money at farmers markets, for instance.
No, that's good. We have to, as you said, as Vivian said, we don't have a perfect economic society. We never will.
We never will.
But we have to try and make it better. And one of the things we make it better is we try and support local initiatives, things that are nearby, our neighbors, our friends, and so on, even though we pay an economic price in a sense, but the spiritual benefits, you know, and the social benefits are far, far greater than the minimal price of, you know, that we pray.
We'll return to the Formed Book Club with Father Joseph Fezzio, Vivian Doudreau, and Joseph Pierce in just a moment. Hi, this is Chris McGregor of Discerning Hearts, inviting you to an extraordinary opportunity to join Father Timothy Gallagher for an expanded and extensive online Discerning Hearts seminar retreat on the discernment of spirits, as taught by St. Ignatius of Loyola. This will be the longer form material similar to the teaching Father Gallagher provides to seminaries and spiritual direction formation programs. This is a dive deeper than ever before into the 14 rules of spiritual discernment, which will take place on 3 consecutive Saturdays, with each day comprised of 4 different conference talks, all beginning on Saturday, May 30th. There will be time for question and answers after each conference talk with Father Gallagher. Each day shall last approximately 5 hours. This will provide nearly 15 hours of live formation with Father Timothy Gallagher, renowned spiritual master of the discernment of spirits. The talks will be available for on-demand viewing by participants who wish to review or for those who missed the live webinar broadcast. But you must be a registered participant to be able to access those recordings. Handout material will be emailed to participants several days prior to the sessions. To find out more and to register, go to discerninghearts.com for this online Discerning Hearts Seminar Retreat. A prayer of St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Take, Lord, and receive all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will, all that I have and call my own. You have given all to me. To you, Lord, I return it. Everything is yours. Do with it what you will. Give me only your love and your grace. That is enough for me. Amen.
Hello, my name is Deacon Omar Gutierrez, and I want to ask you to support Discerning Hearts in a special way. We, Chris McGregor, the board, and I all know that not everyone listening can help financially. We know we have listeners from all parts of the world, and we have made a commitment since the beginning to make the truths shared through Discerning Hearts totally free. So while you may not be able to contribute financially, what you can do is certainly pray, but also give us positive reviews on whatever platform you use to listen to us. If it's iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Spotify, however it is that you get these podcasts, or if you're on YouTube and you like our videos, please give us a good rating and write a review. The more good ratings and reviews we get, the higher our profile, and the more listeners will discover us, listeners who may have the means to contribute in the future. Please consider rating us and writing a positive review today.
We now return to the Formed Book Club with Father Joseph Fezzio, Vivian Doudreau, and Joseph Pierce.
Well, you know, a very good takeaway from this little bit of conversation is this. You know, a lot of people wring their hands. There's nothing we can do. There's nothing we, oh, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. There's nothing we can do, right? There's a feeling of powerlessness. And if you take, Joseph, your principle that every time you buy something, that's a moral act, meaning an opportunity to do good.
Right.
An opportunity to good. Every penny you spend is an opportunity to try to do some good. Every moment of time that you spend is an opportunity to do something good. You know, if people would just realize the potential they have to do good and that it does make a difference, even if it's only a small difference.
Absolutely, Vivian. I'm glad we're ending with agreement here. But, you know, but that's all that we're ever called to do. I'm one person. I can't make the world a perfect place. What I can do is make the world a better place. And that's what I'm called to do as a Christian. And that's just everybody I meet, both economically in the market or everybody I meet in any other sense. I'm called to make the world a better place because of the fact that I'm in it. And, you know, if when I die, the world's a worse place because I'm in it, I'm in trouble.
Well, that is a very good reminder of the moral responsibility that we bear, and that that's a good thing to have moral action, meaning the action to choose well, that this is a powerful force we have in our lives that does make a difference. It does matter. And to re-empower people to think of themselves as that way is
and
a good thing.
It's not just a question of humanistically feeling better because I left the world a little better than I found it, you know. But rather, this is the way you fulfill the second commandment of loving your neighbor, by trying to do better, which is better for him, you know.
Well, you know, the going back to the cardinal here, he does say,
what page?
This is page 158. You know, right after this very shocking, we're in a lethal crisis and, you know, it's all going downhill. He does say, the church preserves what is most human in man. She is the guardian of civilization. And, you know, if you take that church and break it down to all the members of the church, I am the guardian of civilization. You're the guardian of civilization. You're the guardian of civilization. Your choices do matter. And that by choosing what's better for a fellow human being, you are upholding the dignity of human beings. And that's what this whole section of the book is about, upholding the dignity of the human person. And so these choices, I'm trying to bring us back to the book.
Yeah, but you remind me, our good friend Ray Dennehy was professor of philosophy at the University of San Francisco for many years. And he often spent time with students. He'd come home late. His wife would say, you know, you're spending a lot of time there. Can't you go? And he said, I'm saving Western civilization.
See? Yeah. And boy, was he ever. You know, every year he would go to UC Berkeley campus and debate the head of Planned Parenthood, or at least some representative of Planned Parenthood, in a big assembly room, and it would be packed out. And you know what? He won every single time. I mean, objective observers of this debate came away saying, well, I have to admit the man won. And he did that every year faithfully for decades. Yeah. And you just have no idea how many people had their minds changed or their hearts softened because of the things that he said.
Yeah. Right. Lives changed, lives saved, everything. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's move forward one page.
Yeah, one little page at a time.
Oh, yes.
I've got 162 unless you're going to trump me.
No,
well, I'm going to trump you because I can only get to page 159 here.
He's a slow reader.
You carry on, Father. I'm in no hurry. This is good book. We can stay here all year. I'm happy.
At the top of this. That's right. This can be a year-long thing.
Exactly.
More profoundly, the church makes herself the guardian of human nature, not just civilization, but human nature.
Mm-hmm.
The immense misunderstanding that prevails on this subject with the modern world is frightening. When the church defends the lives of children by fighting against abortion, when she defends marriage by showing the profound harmfulness of divorce, when she preserves the conjugal relationship by warning against the dead end of homosexual relations, what a list, huh? When she tries to protect the dignity of the dying against the temptation of euthanasia, when she warns against the dangers of gender ideology and transhumanism, in reality, she makes herself the servant of humanity and the protectress of civilization.
Amen.
Wow.
What a great sentence.
That is a great sentence. And you know, yeah. in each category, again, we could look at these as just these big issues that the agenda's already set, the pieces on the board are already in movement, there's nothing we can do. Oh, really? Well, you know, every time someone is praying a rosary outside of an abortion clinic, every time someone's willing to take into their home, you know, a woman in a crisis pregnancy through the Gabriel Project, or, you know, these might seem like small things, but you know what? It made a difference for that person.
Well, and yeah, and exactly, Vivian, and you know, and Cardinal Sarah on several occasions, which has warms my heart, in this book, quotes Alexander Solzhenitsyn. You know, 100 yes. years ago, you know, it would have seemed impossible that any individual could do anything to overcome the power of communism. That, you know, that the Iron Curtain was permanent, the Berlin Wall was permanent. None of these things would come tumbling down. And it actually was by actions of individuals from the greats, such as St. John Paul II, down to ordinary individuals who were dissidents that were just doing their best to resist the tyranny. So, you know, if people start telling us now that because the latest ideological fad is in the ascendant, therefore it's going to win. No, well, history shows us otherwise. It takes courageous people to resist the evil, possibly at great cost to themselves, but the consequence of that is the evil partly destroys itself and is partly brought down by the courage of those who resist it.
That's right. And not to mention the fact that the battle between good and evil is going on in every human heart.
Yeah, that's Alexander Solzhenitsyn's, actually that's that quote from Solzhenitsyn, exactly.
And so by resisting it, even if you get dragged off somewhere and are never heard from again, if you win the battle in your own heart, you've won.
Right, and not least, of course, because your life does not end when your mortal life is taken from you. So the final victory is something which transcends.
Even before that, though, we're part of the mystical body.
Exactly.
Your victory, my victory, her victory is everybody's victory.
Right.
Yes.
And thank God, because there are a lot of times when I'm not victorious. And so I love that image of the treasury of merit of the church, you know. Father, what's the quote?
Well, every day before communion at Mass, we say a little prayer. Look not on my sins, but on the faith of the church. Boy, is that a consoling thing.
It's so consoling, because those times when I do lack faith and those times when I do succumb to temptation or whatever, I feel like there's this big treasury with all these deposits in it. And my little debit is going to be made up for by somebody else's bigger credit. At least I sure hope it's going to be.
I'm going to trump you again because I'm still on the same page. I'm not going to read this whole book paragraph by paragraph, but it just so happens that this particular section for me was full of really powerful, you know, condensed, crystallized statements.
Yes.
Just made everything which we experienced so clear. Okay, so one on the paywall, last third. Bishops do not seek to take control over consciences. They take seriously their mission as defensor civitatis, you know, defender of the state or the civilization, defenders of cities and of civilization, exclamation point. Believe me, I know from experience that the bishop is sometimes the last recourse against oppression. He's going to say, why? Precisely because we have no political interest, because through our consecration, we have renounced the search for secular power and money. We are free. It is necessary to have given away everything in order to have nothing more to lose and to gain a true freedom of speech and action. Now, his example. In Guinea, I had to take up the defense of my people against the dictatorship of Sekou Touré. I protested against the violent repression by the enemies of liberty. I do nothing different today. And by the way, the former ordinary, the archbishop, was put in prison by Touré. And Robert Seurat was made bishop at a very young age. And this president, Sekou Touré, tried to co-opt him to get him to support this communist government. And he refused. He was actually on an execution list. The government was out to execute him. And that's when John Paul II pulled him out into Rome. To become, I think mm-hmm. he became prefect for the congregation, something like that. But this man, Seurat, as a young bishop, mm-hmm. he just said no. Okay. I do nothing different today in fighting against the enemies of men. No one will silence me. Quote, if we were silent, the very stones would cry out. Luke. I will defend the true meaning of human freedom to the end. I will never abandon man to the ravings of the enemies of human nature. They threaten us. They tell us, be quiet. You're losing popularity. You're not well regarded by the media world. You risk losing your faithful. I am not here to be popular or to increase the numbers in the churches or on the social networks. Profound love for all my brethren in humanity that animates my soul forbids me to be silent. The church has always stood up against ideologies. The bishops have paid the price of blood for having opposed Nazism, communism, and all sorts of racism. Never will I be complicit by any silence in this new ideology of hatred for man and for human nature. The same is true of our love for God and our brethren.
Wow.
Those are powerful words, and they don't ring hollow precisely because we know his personal history. He has already suffered at the hands of a dictatorship. He knows what this is. And as you, to your point, Joseph, they end up destroying themselves. Where is that President Touré of Guinea now?
Exactly.
Right? He's no longer in power. I don't know the current...
And we should say, by way of sort of putting a sobering element into this, that Cardinal Seurat is not necessarily typical even of the hierarchy of the church. As an Englishman, I think that only St. John Fisher had the courage to withstand the tyranny of Henry VIII. And we know in the church today that for every Cardinal Seurat, there are a number of bishops that have effectively sold their souls to the zeitgeist, to the spirit of the age, and are indeed basically living in lives of comfort at the cost of the souls of their flock. And God, well, yeah, I'll stop there.
But so we hope he's a model and inspiration to all other bishops, just as he's a model inspiration for us. We can't do what he does because he's working on the world scene, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we can in South Carolina, in San Francisco, whatever, through the media here, we can try and do what he's doing, not be silent, but protect human dignity and civilization.
Mm-hmm. Show the courage that he shows, exactly.
We cut a couple of pages.
But what he does next is, you know, he's saying he's going to stand up against the current anti-human ideologies of our time. And they, as you know, Joseph, they just keep changing their mask. They're always the same thing at the end of the day, right?
They're all different manifestations of pride. Basically, it's all about pride. It's all about the original sin. Just taking on new masks in new generations, but it's the same old sin in a new packaging.
Right. And as we said when we first started this section, so at the root of that is the denial that I'm made by God and owe my existence to him, and therefore the givenness of things, including human nature, including sexuality, male and female, all these things are a given, and I need to respect that. Well, if I take away God, I take away creation, then all these things are subject to my power, so I think. And so what does he do? He says, talks about gender theory, right after these moving words of resisting current ideologies, because gender theory is kind of at the top of the list right now, right? That we can remake
male and female. It's having its day. It's having its day.
Yeah, it's having its day at the moment. In fact, I just heard from a friend of mine in the medical profession that here in the San Francisco Bay Area, they've just opened, not sure who they are, 10 transgender clinics for children, 10. And they are receiving 10 new patients at each of these clinics every week. That's 100 children every week seeking gender realignment.
And it coincides with the fact that the suicide rate for 10 to 14-year-olds has tripled in the last 10 years. So again, you know, if you get the two graphs here, right? One axis, you've got tolerance levels, and the other axis, you've got suicide rate. And you actually look at the curve for both of them, they actually parallel each other exactly. The more tolerant we become, the more people become suicidal.
Because we're tolerating the wrong things. You know, tolerance is a civic virtue if what it means is, because you disagree with me, I'm not going to blow up your house. You know? That's tolerance. We disagree. I respect that.
But when you start sexualizing 10-year-olds, all you do is confuse them. All right? You're taking away their innocence. You're taking away their childhood and long before they're ready for it. And so you end up with an increase in the suicide rate.
Right.
I mean, because it's not rocket science. It's obvious.
If you think about it, the word devil means to divide. And when you start to, and the state of California just recently passed a law, the public school teachers here are required by law to tell kindergartners that they have to choose whether they're boys or girls. You are actually putting, sowing in that child a division in his very heart over what and who he is. This is, I'm sorry to use the word because it seems to be overused, but this is demonic. Mm-hmm. This is,
it is
the demonic.
But the other thing about it, of course, is it's absolutely unsustainable. I mean,
yes.
It's going to come crashing on its face, you know, within a generation.
Well, what's
it's just
going
to be horrible, but it's going to be very short-lived because this is just crazy.
Well, what I predict is going to happen is that a lot of these children who will be the guinea pigs of this insane movement, when they get older and find out how damaged and maimed they have been made, they're going to sue. And as soon as people get their assets
right.
taken from them, they'll change their tune. I'm sorry.
Right.
That's
yes,
gonna...
right. In England, there's already a Daily Telegraph talking about the number of women that became men that now want to change back to being
right.
women and are not very happy at all at being sold the whole transhumanist thing. So it's already beginning to happen.
Right. Well, let's just pray it happens faster. Maybe we should be doing rosaries outside of these gender realignment clinics as well. So in any case,
well,
gender ideology.
So now
I think we've gone beyond our 30
yeah,
minutes.
Now that we've covered 5 pages, I think that we should conclude this section and that we will return next week to continue this discussion. And, of course, why are we spending so much time on such few, you know, so few pages? Because it's so rich, and he's such a good analyst of what's happening.
Yeah, he is.
And he's striking a chord with us. So we'll
it's
be
such,
back.
It's such an important book, and I'm very happy to take our time with it. I don't see why we should feel any, you know, compulsion to be getting through it.
No.
Let's take it as it comes. It's worth the time.
Amen. So, see you all next week. God bless you all.
Thank you for joining us for the Formed Book Club, brought to you by Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute. For more information on how you can instantly get thousands of movies, faith-filled programs, audio presentations, and ebooks, go to formed.org. To get a copy of the book discussed on this program, Cardinal Seurat's The Day Is Now Far Spent, go to your local Catholic bookstore or online at ignatius.com.